Thanks, Steve. So we initially had the idea of gathering people in a somewhat informal kind of roundtable format to talk about the somewhat hackneyed topic of counterinsurgency in Afghanistan. That's kind of become a dirty word in this town the last couple of months to maybe the last 2 years or so, as people have tried to reorient over what they see as failures or unfulfilled promises in both Iraq and in Afghanistan. But despite all of that, I think we still have a lot of things to think about, both in terms of how we've gotten to where we are today, although I hope that's going to be a relatively small part of what we discuss, and then also where we can go from right now. And ultimately, I mean, unless we're really drawing lessons from the past, there's only so much good that recriminating ourselves over and over and over again on things that went wrong will get us. So with that in mind, I mean, the three people that we have here today, they're not the usual kind of celebrity pundit spokespeople that you have at these kinds of events, talking about either COIN or about Afghanistan. And that's because everyone here has very detailed personal experience working at the implementation level inside Afghanistan. To a much lesser extent, I did. I haven't deployed there with the military since 2009, so I'm quite some time out of date. Everyone here has much more recent experience. And with that, what I'm hoping emerges is after they've presented their perspectives on both where we are right now and what we have to look forward to, either from local militia forces, from the police, from the transition strategy, from how Pakistan and Iran are going to balance the United States post-withdrawal, or anything else that they can think of coming up with, that will then be including the rest of you in the discussion, not just a question and answer, but actually having a substantive back and forth about how we can understand the future, how we can think about how that future is shaping up, and then also what U.S. policymakers can possibly do to try to plan for it moving forward. So all of you have seen the invitation, which I suppose is why you RSVP'd and showed up. So I'm not going to belabor everyone's biographies. So without further ado, I mean, Matt, why don't you start us off with your perspective?
Sure. My name is Matt Freer. I'm a fellow of the American Security Project. I was involved in Afghanistan initially in 2007 when I joined the British government in Kabul, working at the embassy there. I then subsequently worked in London on Afghanistan and returned to Helmand during Operation Mushtraq to do some strategic communications work during that operation. I just wanted to make some general points, I think, about where the strategy is going on Afghanistan, particularly in the short term. Time is running out, but I think there are some lessons we can take from what's happened recently to make some gains. All is not lost will be one of my main points. So I think looking forward from where we are now means two things. This point about where the public debate in the United States is going in terms of very little discourse about what the future strategy should look like for the next 18 months, but also taking the lessons of Afghanistan to other conflicts which might actually be around the corner and very, very imminently to be learned. All is not lost. And we must continue to try and work to do as much as we can in Afghanistan to affect the best outcome. We are still obviously so heavily invested. There is still a lot that can be done through the United States and her partners through development and diplomacy, and we should continue to maintain the alliances we've built so far. And as Josh referred to, start to look more widely in the region as to how to achieve our objectives. We must strive to continue to understand what happened and is happening in Afghanistan. We can't allow the return of international terrorism. That has to be something we have to keep our eye on, even as we start to draw down troops. There are some valid concerns about imminent civil war, government collapse, which is why we must try and make sure that we get the best that we can get out in the next 18 months. Already many institutions of the US and their allies have learnt a lot of lessons at the technical level. When I was in Helmand during Operation Mushtraq, it was the first large-scale joint operation between Afghan, American and other allied forces, and it involved not only a very thought-out military strategy but also a thought-out Afghan government component, the concept of government in a box, the involvement of police that were all ready to come in and take on responsibilities right after the troops successfully cleared the area of Taliban. That had some success, but we must try and take the lessons that have been learned at the technical level, which, and there are so many people now who have had experience in Afghanistan, and try to apply them at the higher level in terms of what is realistic and what is achievable. And that is really one of the key lessons. We must try and focus on a strategy that is agreeing on an objective that is achievable with resources, with all the political parameters that we have to face, so that the strategy it can actually be achieved. During my time in Afghanistan, I saw up close some of the difficulties that governments have in sustaining the support and consent of the population back home in the face of the global spread of news and information, particularly in the context of what is quite a violent asymmetric campaign. And that is that sort of constraint on the strategy is something that cannot be ignored. Again, on a technical level, obviously the militaries have learned so much from adapting to the situation on the ground. A lot of lessons have been learned in terms of tactics of counterinsurgency. And it's notable that in the reference that David Kilcullen makes in some of his literature to the tactics, he makes reference to what the alternative is that the counterinsurgency campaign is pushing forward. What's the alternative that is being presented in this case to the Afghan population, and focusing on that strategic aspect obviously is key, and there is still some time left to try and adjust to the realities on the ground. And also the element of time periods. I mean, I've mentioned it several times, we're now very much in the closing episodes of this stage of involvement of the United States and our allies in Afghanistan. So we must think about how best to use that time, how best to make sure that the populations in the United States and in Afghanistan are with us as we try to achieve the outcomes that can help to build lasting stability in Afghanistan. I think also we still have some time to learn and build on what we've learnt about the Taliban and the alliances and where any political negotiations could go with the Taliban. What it seeks, what it doesn't seek to do, and who are its friends and enemies. These are all important factors that we should try to bring together into one solid idea of thinking in terms of how to build stability, how to build a more representative government that doesn't create instability when there are potentially elections in 2014. So we need to build a perception of governance over government. I mean, there's been a lot of work on this already, but I think the focus still needs to be not on the personalities, but on building institutions of governance that can be stable when troops depart in 2014 and that can still be representative and maintain basic political and human rights. So the story very much goes from the technical level of what we've learned to taking those lessons for the last 18 months of this sort of involvement in Afghanistan to take them to the strategic level so that we can build stability and accept that there are very, very real parameters for what can be achieved, but also try and push for a more representative form of government that isn't going to impinge on basic political rights. Those are my points.
All right. Thanks, Matt. Nick, do you want to take over?
Hello. I'm British as well. I'm sort of sorry about that. It's not the British Security Project. There we are. We are the only two British adjunct fellows, I think. I went to Afghanistan for the first time in 2006, again with the British government. I initially was in Helmand and then in Kabul. I was doing counter-narcotics and policing. I did that through to 2008. I went back in 2010 to do reintegration, the process of persuading low and mid-level Taliban to rejoin society. So I'm an expert at futility in Afghanistan. The I've also done an insurgency as well, which is kind of interesting. I was in Libya last year with the National Transitional Council in Benghazi immediately after the no-fly zone was declared, and it was interesting to be on the other side of this kind of paradigm. I'm going to make the tedious semantic points first, I'm afraid. If you ask me if counterinsurgency, what counterinsurgency was like in Afghanistan, I would say it would be a good idea. I'm not actually sure if we've ever really done counterinsurgency there. I think the phrase counterinsurgency is used more as what it's not. Now, in the military, we're talking about counterinsurgency. What they really mean is not having a big tank battle with the Russians in the Fulda Gap. When the and related to that is the issue of what winning looks like. I'm uncertain what winning is. I mean, just speaking as a Brit, I think, not speaking on behalf of the British government, I think the actual reason why the British are in Afghanistan is to be good allies of the Americans. That's our strategic objective, which makes it very hard to sell domestically beyond that. And our political leaders have tried and failed to do that. Knowing what winning looked like in Helmand, which is where I've got the most experience, always used to interest me. The Afghan population clearly hated the British. But they hated the British before we got there. We're the, for those who don't know, we're the sort of cultural bogeymen of Afghanistan. We're the thing which mothers threaten to get their children with if they don't behave. You know, the English will come and get you. So they didn't like us. We got that. And they didn't particularly like the Americans either, nothing personal. And they didn't like the Taliban, and they didn't like the Afghan government. In fact, they hated all four of those groups. And I used to think that success probably just looked like rearranging the sort of squash ladder of those four to mean the Brits and the Americans were essentially irrelevant in this. It didn't matter what they thought of us. It's all we just wanted them to dislike the Taliban more than they disliked their own government. And that was a form, a definition of success there. What was certainly not going to work there, though, was the classic counterinsurgency paradigm. You know, this thing about a choice between the government or the insurgents. I don't think in Afghanistan, certainly in the bits I'm familiar with, that was ever a realistic choice. Mostarak, which Matt mentioned, is a really interesting example of this. For those who can't remember, there have actually been a few Operation Mostaraks. The name has been used at various times. But this was the 2010 sort of flagship operation to remove the Taliban from Marja, which was presented as a Taliban stronghold. And it was an enormously successful military operation by the US Marine Corps. But there's something just interesting happened in the margins of that, which I was always struck by. At the same time as the Marines were in 3 days clearing Marja of the Taliban, highly effectively, the British area of operations immediately to the north, we had a huge spike in violence against police checkpoints. And we saw that through our own prism, and we saw that as the Taliban militarily responding in a way in which they could. It made perfect sense. And so we responded to that in all the ways we you normally would. We increased our joint patrolling with the ANP. We put more more ANA out there. We didn't have a lot because they were mostly focused on Mostarak. And we targeted in all the usual ways. And it took us about a couple of months to realise what was actually going on. A corrupt, malign district chief of police and his checkpoint commanders, which essentially function as little patrol bases, were seizing land off farmers, driving subsistence farmers off their land, removing them from their sole asset. And we put ourselves firmly on the side of the people who were doing that for the Afghans. Not only that, from the Afghan population, this is the Afghan government doing this to them. Now, the total bench for Afghanistan, and this is dated, this is Helmand in 2010, the total governmental bench, 14 districts, in 10 of them there were district governors. They might have had a few people with them, family, friends, secretaries, a couple of bodyguards. There was 3 district directors for line ministries. one for education, one for health, and one for agriculture, across the whole province, not three in each district. We have one district director in one province, in one district director in another district. We had, I think, five judges, four prosecutors, and a population of about 1.5 million people. Some of these districts had 250,000 people living in them. So it's difficult to see how the government, Afghan government, possibly could be an effective choice in that. The only bit of the Afghan government people were having contact with was the police. And frankly, yeah, one third of them in Helmand were addicted to opiates. Predatory, malign, unpleasant. So the classic kind of coin thing doesn't work. So really it becomes a choice, instead of a government, instead of living in the Islamic Emirate or living in the current Islamic Republic, it really becomes a choice between self-governance or Taliban government in rural areas. And that really means things like tribes and like community development committees, where they worked. But those things are hard to establish. The Brits in Helmand did a very, very good program under ASOP, the Afghan Social Outreach Program, which established district development assemblies. Now, Afghanistan has enough elections, but one of the things it did was it would bring together 600 people, a list developed, obviously, with the Afghans, but with a contribution from ourselves just to nudge it so that it was in some way broadly representative. So you'd end up with 600 people who mattered in each district in a room, and they would form an electoral college, vote 45 of their members as district development assembly. Then you give them $110 million over 3 years. And two things happen. Firstly, 45 people is enough for politics. The provincial councils with 12 members, it's not enough for politics. They don't actually have anything to politic about. And you give them the $110 million to fight over. And these things allowed a form of governance to grow, which becomes an inoculation against whatever the Taliban might do in the future. And it's the kind of thing which seems to me historically to have worked. It took a lot of money and a lot of time. Couldn't necessarily be replicated everywhere. Just a couple of other points about why it hasn't gone as well as it possibly could have done. I think we've been focused too much on doing the wrong thing. I think Afghanistan is the needs. People in Afghanistan clearly have very many needs. But a great deal of the money which we've poured into Afghanistan has gone into things like healthcare and education, agricultural development. I'm not suggesting those things don't matter or aren't helpful, but they're generally purely development. Doing development tasks and expecting them to have a counterinsurgency or stabilization outcome is possibly a mistake. This is a glib point, but the Taliban aren't offering healthcare. Therefore, the conflict's not necessarily about healthcare. Conflict's about security and justice. Those are the things which the population articulate. The Asia Foundation have just done their latest poll, and it shows people being increasingly the victims of non-political violence in areas which are insecure. Now, this isn't violence by the Taliban. This is violence by criminals. It's something which we've just failed to address so far. And this is the Taliban's card. It's the one thing they can offer. It was a form of justice. It might be ruthless and it might be arbitrary, but it does something. The other thing I think we have as a problem, which we bring to it, is that we're not necessarily equipped to do things like counterinsurgency, actually. Our military wasn't, our development agencies aren't, they exist to do development, and our political organisations, the State Department, the Foreign Office, they exist to talk to elites. They don't exist to talk to populations. There are a few bits in the military who have always done this and always done this very well, from the Americans, and particularly Special Forces and their associated regular Civil Affairs Brigade. They are effective at this, but there's only so many of those guys. There's a lot of Afghanistan and a lot of the rest of the world to get around. My last point is about what happens next. And I'm actually going to talk about America rather than Afghanistan. Come 2014, you will remove your combat troops. Special Forces will stay behind. So will aviation assets, intelligence assets, all that. Your European and other allies will get out of there as quickly as they possibly can. We've proved ourselves to be good allies. What happens next? Well, depending how you cut it, somewhere between 60 and 90% of the Afghan state is funded by the American taxpayer. Now, it depends how you cut it. Do we talk about defense in that? If you just take the civilian side, So the 2 billion of civilian support, which they need post-2014 each year, it's about 60-something percent of the Afghan state's expenditure. I'm interested how the United States will continue to fund Afghanistan once combat troops have withdrawn. Because I'm not sure domestically how that will continue to play. I'm not sure that you continue to fund Iraq. I don't know, and I'm very cautious as a Brit, or even mentioning Vietnam to an American audience, but I'm not sure how much you funded the Vietnamese government at the end. But this thing which I would be very surprised at is that over the next 10 years, you continue to maintain the funding levels for Afghan civilian state as you do at the moment. And it, clearly, if you take away somewhere between 60 and 90% of the Afghan state's cash, it stops working. Not that it's probably working particularly well anyway. So I'm actually reasonably pessimistic about it. And I think that problem possibly gets exacerbated if the peace process works. Because if the peace process works and you have some form of Islamic extremist representation within the Afghan government, be it doesn't have to be the Taliban, it can be HIC, it can be His Islami Gulbuddin, but people who make us itch, suddenly you've got the domestic optic of either we're funding, if you're on the, I'm simplifying this glibly, if you were the people who cared about the war, you would say, hang on, we're now funding the guys who were fighting. And if you care about social issues, and I know they're not mutually exclusive, you would now say, hang on a second, we're funding people who want to put women in burqas and legalize rape within marriage. And I can't see the cash keep going, and that makes me very, very pessimistic about the future of Afghanistan. Thank you.
All right, David.
My name is David Young. I'm a conflict resolution specialist here in D.C., and I was a civilian advisor to coalition forces in eastern Afghanistan in 2011. I'd like to talk a little bit about local security forces and the dynamic that they'll play in the future as we draw down. Traditionally, it's often said that Afghans don't take enough responsibility for their own security, that they smoke a lot of drugs, that they're lazy, that they don't care, and to a certain extent, this is certainly true. To a certain extent, it's not. But more broadly, I feel that it's interesting to note that Afghans do take a great deal of responsibility for their own security. It's just not the way we conceive of it, and it's not at the national level. Security in Afghanistan over the last several hundred years is local. Everything is local. Due to the complete absence of central government in Afghanistan and treacherous terrain that isolates various districts from one another that are 5 miles away, but they haven't spoken in generations, it is very obvious why they value and rely on local security so much. In the southeast, what are called Arbakais, or Pashtun militias, locally grown, locally defended, it's basically the premises as a result of a local ruling or a local threat from an external community. You'll have people gathering and enlisting a local force to repel outside enemies. Across the border in northwest Pakistan, you'll have what are called Lashkars, which is you'll see in the news a lot, Pakistani Taliban attacking them a great deal because of their anti-Taliban presence and anti-Taliban motivations and actions. And over the last 30 years, this local defense mentality has sort of become rabid through the Soviet anti-Soviet jihad, through the Civil War. It has become taken on a life of its own with all the weapons pouring into the country from all over the region and from us in Saudi Arabia. And this has led to, instead of just local defense, reliance on warlord militias, as I'm sure many of you are aware. Then we come in and we insist on big hierarchy, big army, everything coherent, everything right down the middle with tree structures and orders of battle, and it doesn't jive very well with Afghans, especially Pashtuns. So I anticipate, or what happened then was essentially that the militias that had been dominating the civil war in the country for so long saw an opportunity to get exactly what they wanted all along, power, money, influence, but not by being a militia, by disbanding, joining the government, and using and obtaining significant defense and humanitarian contracts throughout the country. So they sort of became in a holding pattern for the last 10 years, for the most part, most of them. And as we draw down, I anticipate that they will return to what they know best, which is local security. During that time, during the last 12 years or so, we have indulged this tendency, this gravity toward local security, simply because we recognize its value, at least in theory. We've had tried things like the Afghan Auxiliary Police, the Afghan Public Protection Program, which was recently co-opted, started in Wardak and then became the defense contractor or humanitarian development worker protection force throughout the country at Karzai's insistence. There's the Community Defense Initiative, the Local Defense Initiative, the Community-Based Security Solutions. All these four, the Community-Based Security Solutions is a force that I worked closely with in my time in eastern Afghanistan with nascent uprisings that we were hoping to become local defense forces, sponsored local defense forces. And the results have been completely mixed. Some of them prey and rape and pillage nonstop, and others defend their communities like true patriots. Nonetheless, they are not standardized. They are completely hit and miss. And as a result, 2 years ago in 2010, the ALP, the Afghan Local Police Program, was started to standardize this effort, to make something coherent, to drive it forward, to fill the security vacuum in areas where we are unable, unwilling to patrol, and certainly Afghan National Security Forces are unwilling to patrol. They're usually 100 to 200 strong in any given district. They cover down on a village, a cluster of villages, an entire valley, or several valleys. In any given district, they're beholden to a strong man usually. We like to think that they're not. We'd like to think that they are beholden to the district chief of police, and on paper, in theory, they certainly are. But sometimes that's not the case. Accountability has made it so that, or accountability, the desire for accountability has made them beholden to shuras. Shuras have to nominate these groups of men and these fighters, and frequently it backfires because, as we all know, just because they're on a shura doesn't mean they're reliable or trustworthy or loyal to the government. But that is the name of the game. The ALP is subject to tremendous horse trading in Kabul. Bismillah Khan, who was recently in Minister of Interior and now the Minister of Defense, was known for promoting Tajik ALP lists and rosters over the Pashtun ones because he's an ethnic Tajik. Don't make no mistake about it, Pashtuns are the exact same thing when they're in charge. It's just, that's the nature of the game. Personality clashes. We had a great deal of difficulty getting funding and support for forces in the East, and because of personality clashes between provincial governors, provincial police chiefs, and things of that nature. Again, ALP has had wild success in some areas and complete disaster in others, nightmarish, embarrassing disaster. But the question is, Kabul has grown very fond of them because it's a formula. It's something. It's something that's coherent, and it's made progress. And in Afghanistan, if something worked 50% of the time, it may as well work 100% of the time, just simply because of perspective and everything else that plays into it. But will ALPs fill the security vacuum as we draw down? And right now they are at about 16,000 strong spread across the country, with another 14,000 projected by the end of 2014. So we're talking 30,000. By this stage in the Soviet withdrawal, Najibullah had 170,000 irregular forces throughout the country, by contrast, and 400,000 conventional forces. So the question everyone's asking, of course, is there going to be a civil war? And I have a few predictions on the matter. Because of budget constraints, the regular forces, the Afghan National Forces, which are currently at 350,000, are projected to decrease or contract to 230,000. Because that would bring the budget down from about just over $5 billion to just over $4 billion. And what that means is that some people have to pay for them and some people don't. And Kabul has taken on responsibility for paying for $500 million of it. So Afghan forces are going to contract considerably. What does that mean? It's going to happen at the same time we're contracting our forces and withdrawing our forces. Right now, as it stands, as of April, only 13 of 156 ANA battalions are, quote, independent with advisors. Because there were so few that were technically independent, they abandoned the criteria of just independent and made it independent with advisors, because last year only one of them qualified for the standard. Now, in April, they're up to 13 out of 156. They cannot hold down their own territory. They can certainly not secure additional territory. When I was in Nuristan, just across a neighboring Kunar, we were withdrawing from certain areas because population or counterinsurgency doctrine demanded that we withdraw from areas like the Korangal Valley and the Pech Valley because there were no people there. And as we did that, we left certain Kandaks or Afghan battalions and brigades in place and pushed them very, very hard. Do not abandon your post. And within days, they abandoned their post when we withdrew. They did not join the Taliban. In all honesty, they did not join the Taliban, but they disbanded, abandoned their posts, and regrouped somewhere in Kabul to be deployed elsewhere. So with examples like this, it's clear that as they draw down, as we draw down, and as Afghan forces draw down, the focus will be on cities and population structures, population centers, and not just Kandahar, Herat, Kabul, but areas, you know, like Tar and Khat with just tens of thousands of people. That will be the focus. What that means is that what Northwest Pakistan has been will transfer over across the border into eastern Afghanistan. Bin Laden even recommended that his fighters in Northwest Pakistan take safe haven, take refuge across the border in Kunar, in Nuristan, to get away from the heat of the drones in Northwest Pakistan. That will absolutely be the case. They will move over, and the question is what will we do about it? As in Waziristan, there will be continued drone strikes, amplified drone strikes in Afghanistan. There have been very few so far, mostly in Kunar province. It will accelerate dramatically because our Special Operations Forces and CIA will be stretched thin as it is down to a residual force of maybe 10 to 20,000. That's still completely unknown, the amount of forces remaining after the drawdown is complete. But what they will do is they will continue doing drone strikes, or they will amplify drone strikes and continue in capture kill raids, which on average in 2011 was around 5 to 15 a night across the country. So I mean they're very, very skilled and experienced at doing this. Still, nonetheless, it will not fill the security vacuum. We will be stretched too thinly as it is, and the vacuum will have to be filled some other way. I anticipate that Afghan cities will face the same kind of harassment and terrorism that Iraq is now experiencing. The country itself is not at risk of collapsing by any means, but it is scary as hell, and people are afraid of terrorism constantly. And that will be the case in Afghanistan. So how will they avoid that? How will Kabul, in its infinite wisdom, avoid that? I believe that they will continue doing what they've been doing in Ghazni in the rest of the country, which is arm anti-Taliban resistance movements, which is code in many cases for Hizb Islami and other militia movements that have been dormant, as I mentioned, for the past 10 or so years. In Ghazni, there's been an uprising. It's been hailed across the country and by ISAF forces, or many ISAF forces, not all of them buy it, but many do, that this is an organic uprising, that the people are resisting, and it will spread, because there have been examples of it all over the country. Every rebellion in Afghanistan is completely isolated and has nothing to do with one another. When Quran is burned, those rebellions have to do with one another. But local factions, local actors, and local factors play into local rebellions, nothing more. They do not spread. It is not the Anbar uprising for Afghanistan. Cutely, the district where the Ghazni uprising started is Andar. And so everyone has been very excited about saying, oh, this is the Andar uprising, the Andar awakening. And I just don't buy it based on my experience. So the populations in these areas, I believe, will be subject to a civil war, because Kabul will be deliberately instigating, because they have no other choice, they will deliberately instigate civil war in remote districts of the east and the south, and the east never benefited from the surge. They had 10,000 of the 40,000 surge troops, and so they are far behind the south, and the south is already a mess. So they will deliberately instigate civil war in pockets of the east and the south to avoid civil war in the cities. It may or may not work, but I believe it will work. It's just an absolute recipe for short-term disaster and human rights abuses. The question is there an alternative? And I don't believe there is. They will not have a choice, and 2 years from now they will start campaigning and searching for militias like Hizb Islami, like others who are bailing from the government or developing militant wings of their government factions like Ittihad and others, who will take the fight to the Taliban. And it will be paraded as a legitimate uprising, and that people, you know, taking the fight to the Taliban. Najibullah did the exact same thing, as I mentioned, in the early 90s, and it worked until the Soviet funding collapsed. As Nick mentioned, the funding is completely up in the air. As long as it stays strong, I believe that this strategy, cold-hearted and geopolitical as it is, will work. The Taliban and Al-Qaeda will be bogged down in the east and the south enough to keep the rest of Afghanistan safe, and perhaps safe keeps, according to the American strategic objective, keeps Americans safe as a whole, because they won't be using it as a safe haven, or like in Northwest Pakistan, it's rare for them to be able to squeak out someone, you know, like Faisal Shahzad to come to the U.S. A strong reason why I believe this militia campaign will begin is because as Karzai steps down, or allegedly steps down in 2014, his replacement will be very eager to show that he can bring security to the cities. That means he's going to be that much more rabid in ensuring that the people who do support him and the ones who might support him see that he is doing what he can. That means filling the void by essentially abandoning the support of people in the rural districts, especially in the east, to secure the population districts and the population centers in the main areas. So as long as the funding is pumping in, this strategy will hold. It will face serious setbacks, but as long as the money holds, I believe this will work geopolitically at a strategic level. Thank you.
All right, thanks, you guys. I mean, if I can kind of summarize what you're talking about, essentially, each one of you are discussing from slightly different angles the challenge of managing violence in Afghanistan. David produced probably the weirdly enough, most pessimistic take, I think, of the best that we can hope for is civil war in half the country. But I'd like to kind of pose this as an additional challenge to each one of you, and then we can open up the floor to a more considered discussion. But how would you suggest that the U.S. either play a role or not play a role in managing the problem of violence, specifically spillover violence from Afghanistan that would then threaten either U.S. or Western, if you have to pull the lens out hard enough, interests? So, Matt, do you want to take a stab at it?
Well, yeah, I think I made the point. I think what needs to happen is you need to have the security forces that we're handing over to need to have political responsibility. There's been a lot of talk about different militias, different schemes. The lines of accountability do need to be local. Everyone knows that the governance system in Afghanistan has to be locally driven. So there needs to be a way of including all those different political elements in what we're handing over to in 2014. That is the best way to create stability in a country. It might be quite a brave move politically here, but that needs to be the sort of direction we go in. Otherwise, you're going to have, a maze of armed militia groups. And as pointed out, the likelihood of dwindling resources for the Afghan National Army and the Afghan National Police. So there needs to be a political solution. Which can still happen in the next period.
So what does a political solution look like?
Well, it needs to, with all the methodology that we've got now of who is important, we need to bring those together. We need to push forward on reopening the talks that seem to have got bogged down.
You mean with the Taliban?
With the Taliban, with Pakistan, and the other main actors, to try and bring about some sort of solution. We need to make sure we know what our red lines are. We need to try and bring about stability through that mechanism, so that the security forces, which are an important component, but they are answerable to something which represents the whole country.
Okay. Nick, do you have any thoughts on this?
I would be tempted to think again about what it is you really want to achieve in what is it you actually want out of Afghanistan. And if what you really want out of Afghanistan is people not organising terrorist attacks against US interests outside of Afghanistan, I would address that. And I don't know if you need a extensive continued role in Afghanistan to do that. I used to be a sort of swivel-eyed fan of our presence there, but as time goes on, there's two bits to it, isn't there? There's firstly, what is it we actually want to do? And then the second is, what is it that we actually can do? And even if you find yourself saying that we do need some form, America needs some form of continuous presence in Afghanistan, and it's kind of, again, it falls down with, but can you actually do it? I mean, it's the counterinsurgency point. Counterinsurgency in central Helmand in end of 2010, with four battalion RCTs of the US Marine Corps and 5 battalion brigade of the British Army, we approximated something which looked like the sort of counterinsurgency ratio of troops you need to actually guarantee some form of security for that pocket in time. But there's a There's a line I always have in the back of my mind. It was the British Secretary of Foreign Secretary, David, who was then David Miliband under the last Labour government, came to Helmand. And he went to see Gulab Mangal, the governor. And Mangal's a good governor by the, you know, a communist technocrat, you know, by the lights of Afghan governors. And David Miliband asked Mangal, said, how long once the Brits and the Americans go? How long do you think what we've built here will last? And he could see he was looking for an answer. I don't know, 10 years, 15 years, 30 years. And Mangal went 48 hours. 48 hours off, because once you've gone, I'm gone, you know, and every government public official in Helmand's gone, because we're not going to hang around to get hanged.
Okay. David, do you want to jump onto that?
Sure. Who wants to jump onto that? But it's in Andar. I keep going back to this because it's a microcosm of what I anticipate to come in terms of civil war, limited civil war. We are sitting this one out, this fight out. We are hoping for the best. We're watching Hizb Islami take the fight to the Taliban, and we're seeing the Taliban retreat, and locals are extremely excited because for the first time the Taliban aren't terrorizing them, and yet 10 years ago it was the Taliban that they welcomed in because Hizb Islami was terrorizing them. So the problem is that we're sitting this fight out and giving a great deal of autonomy and authority to Kabul to manage their own problems because they need practice at doing it without us. But at the same time, the support that we provide, that Kabul provides, needs to be overt. The militia strategy, in my eyes, is incredibly covert, and that is its inherent danger, because there's no accountability. No one knows where the support exactly is coming from, whether it's a wink and a nod from Karzai. The chief of NDS now, who was in charge of the Andar uprising, is Asadullah Khalid, and he's got quite the sordid history. But that effort, in contrast to something that has been going on in Nuristan, where there's a district chief of police and a district police force that is completely under siege, and we are flying helicopters. As General John Allen, in an interview with Foreign Policy a couple weeks ago, mentioned that we're flying helicopters in, we're giving them all kinds of support to take the fight to the Taliban, and these are conventional forces and local police doing this. And that, to me, is the way to go. So if you want to counter a civil war, it's overt support for conventional and government-supported forces, not, you know, tongue-in-cheek, hey, go boys, here's my procurement officer, you know, he'll get you set up, you know, right around the corner. Like, that attitude, to me, is extremely dangerous, but again, it will solve the strategic problem, in my eyes, if it's executed well. It's just going to be a bloodbath.
All right, so, I mean, we have some, I think, fascinatingly divergent opinions on this, then, ranging the gamut from a fully managed political solution to simply lowering our expectations to hopefully trying to manage whatever bloodshed happens afterwards. I mean, presumably there might be some way to actually incorporate all of these into a coherent picture of what's happening, but I'd like to enlist all of your help in gathering some thoughts on this. Before we get going, actually, with comments and with questions, there are a couple of ground rules that we need to get out of the way. First one is state your name and affiliation, because I'm assuming we're not all best friends here, so we need to know who each other are. Secondly, keep it brief. As much as I do want this to be a discussion, and there needs to be a discussion, there's only so many minutes in the hour that we have here. And no one really has, I think, the right to monopolize it. And then if possible, I think it's even in a discussion format, it's still important to try to phrase things as best you can as a question. I mean, ultimately, I think the people who walk into this pretending like we have concrete answers for how to fix all the problems are the ones who get us into the most trouble. And looking at this more as challenges that we need to unravel and less as an exam that has to be answered first out the gate and then you win is probably going to be the most constructive approach. So with that, I'd actually like to pose to everyone. I mean, what's your alternative to these three visions that you've heard announced up here? Yeah.
George Nicholson was correct. For Nick, I think you hit the nail on the head. Dave Barnum, Lieutenant General Barnum, who headed up the force, said, was it 2001 to 2002, said, success depends on strategy, resources, and leadership. And I said, Dave, there's another piece, political resolve. I was in Vietnam for two tours. I remember our great plan for exit at that time was Enhance 1 and Enhance 2. We'll provide them all the money for logistics support. We'll pull out. We'll put the millstone of technology around their necks. We did. 2 years later, Congress said, we're tired of that. We're going to cut off the funding. And we cut off the funding. And I think the bottom line is, no matter what kind of solutions we come up with, and I think we're already seeing it on Capitol Hill, where supporters have turned their backs. What happens, and I think it's a matter of fact that Congress is going to turn off the financial taps. The European allies are they're going to turn off. We turn off the financial taps. How realistic are any other solution sets that we're going to come up with?
Yeah, I mean, does anyone want to?
It's a different subject.
Okay, I mean.
Stanley Kober, no affiliation. We've been focusing on Afghanistan. What if the center of gravity has now shifted to Pakistan itself?
Yeah, I mean, I can actually take a little bit of a stab about that. I mean,
I have a couple of articles. Can I just read a couple sentences from Pakistanis writing about their own country? One is Pervez Gutboy, who is one of their top physicists, writing on the Pakistani army. The reported refusal of some military units to confront the Taliban during last year's South Waziristan operation, he's writing last year, so this is 2010, is said to have shocked senior officers and severely limited their battle options in North Waziristan. You notice they haven't gone into North Waziristan. Post bin Laden, things have worsened. Pakistan's current crop of generals must deal with a heavily Islamicized rank and file brimming with seditious thoughts. Some want to kill their superior officers.
Right.
That's a Pakistani scientist writing about his own army.
There's a little bit from I think to kind of keep this constrained within Afghanistan, because we do have to focus our discussion somewhat. But more recently, there have been reports that Mark Grossman, who is the senior representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan, has been concentrating his discussions primarily on the Pakistani government itself. Previously, when Richard Goldberg was in this role, he was trying to get the Taliban either to come to the Maldives to have discussions, or rumors of them showing up, I think, in Qatar. That's now transmogrified into actually directly approaching the Pakistani government. And I think it's getting at what you're talking about, which is that the Pakistani government itself has a complicated but still nevertheless supportive relationship to a lot of these extremists and a lot of the insurgents that we're dealing with. And ultimately, they're going to be one of the key parties that needs to be involved in any kind of ultimate political solution, assuming we're able to pull one out in the next 20 months or so. But I mean, there's I think, a tacit acceptance that that's the case, and that's why you've seen a lot of discussion about Pakistan. I'd say even more so than about Afghanistan, at least when political elites talk about it in media and places like that. And I think it's getting at what you're describing, which is that Pakistan itself is one of the big problems here. And as long as Pakistan exists as a problem, it's going to be extraordinarily difficult, if not impossible, to really focus on solving Afghanistan.
Isn't there one? If Afghanistan stops to be the issue, doesn't it make dealing with Pakistan so much easier?
In a way.
Because, you know, relying on Pakistan for nothing else, a logistics chain, puts you quite firmly, you know, it's not a natural relationship. You could have a more normal relationship with Pakistan if you didn't have Afghanistan.
So what,
as
I mean,
a concern.
But then what you're describing in a way is a return in both countries to the 90s when we exclude Pakistan, and as a result of our exclusion of Afghanistan as well, they have free rein to function.
Well, I can maybe. I mean, the one thing I would do different, though, is feel free to kill people like Osama bin Laden. But
yeah.
I mean, hearing is glue.
Who are you?
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Akmal Jai. I'm an Afghan journalist working currently for Voice of America. I mean, hearing this gloom and doom analysis is nothing new. We had the ICG report yesterday somehow talking about that government in Kabul will implode rather than the Taliban attacking it. And from the Taliban side, all we hear is that, you know, at least for some level of balanced, you know, analysis of Afghanistan. They say it's all defeat. They're trying to justify their defeat in Afghanistan. How legitimate would it be for us to think that, yes, there should be an acknowledgement that the West failed in Afghanistan? And keeping that in mind, to what extent that will allow a new kind of approach to Afghanistan, a rather new, somewhat to what we experienced in 2001 in Bonn Agreement, a new arrangement for a new political setup, which include the Taliban. You know, we had Lakhdar Ebrahimi talking about his mistakes not to having Taliban in Bonn that led to the resurgence of the Taliban. I'm wondering if there is any appetite in the international community to that sort of engagement.
There might be, but I don't think there's any appetite of domestic political audiences. That's the problem. I don't think there's continued appetite anywhere. Absolutely. I reckon if we sat down now and tried to rewrite the Afghan constitution, we could probably do a better job. But we certainly don't have to have so many elections. We've learned a lot.
How would you come back to your capitals and saying we went to Afghanistan for 11 years, we invested so heavily with blood and treasure, and now we've failed. We failed to either stabilize Afghanistan, to have something that can remain. What's our legacy? I mean, in terms of 11 years, the longest war in American history.
I think we still need to know what we're aiming for, and if we're still, if we are aiming for stability, then we need to look imaginatively about how to do that. We can't just keep on doing the same sort of thing, trying to sort of hold together a sort of a maze of militias from a distance with dwindling resources and, less and less commitment to the country. We need to try and, in the time left, try and make sure that there is some sort of political balancing act that we bring together. Because clearly, all the evidence shows that the current system, it just is not stable.
And precisely that what Avalon would say, that this system for the 11 years have not worked. It needs a change and overall a new approach, new arrangements. I'm not saying that we should maintain the status quo.
No.
Of course,
yeah, so you had some thoughts. Yeah.
Professor Ghazi, I'm associated with a South Asian newspaper, Harbinger Weekly, and I'm from northwest part of Pakistan. Actually, I was late. I did not hear the first two speakers. But my question is, are we here to think about and talk about ending the war or winning the war? If it's ending the war, from that part of the world I know ending of the war is not an option. The only option is winning the war. If you want to end the war, just announce and come back. They will not harm you. It was Al-Qaeda, it was Saudi funding, which did all that. And if you want to win the war, plan for that. Winning the war is an option. We should think about that, because that will bring us peace, the whole region. Ending the war is not, I don't think so, it will work.
Yeah, go ahead.
Mike Schwartz, State Department, Office of Foreign Affairs. Going back to what Nick said about what happens if Afghanistan doesn't become the issue in dealing and what Pakistan does, what role do you believe that the Central Asian states can play in terms of economic development and providing enhanced security within Afghanistan? There's been a lot of talk about Northern Distribution Network, the New Silk Road.
Yeah, that's yeah. I mean, that's something Bob Blake is really positive on. I gotta be honest. I think the State Department is optimistic when it talks about turning the Northern Distribution Network into some regional economic thing. They're gonna butt up against Russia's plan for the Eurasia Union. They're gonna butt up against China trying to reinvigorate the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. They're gonna butt up against almost every leader in Central Asia hating the other person so much that they close their borders just for fun and disrupt everyone's lives. I mean, it's always possible that could happen. And I think definitely once Afghanistan is off the table and the US has the space to focus on something else, it's possible. But I mean, more realistically, the US should probably be looking at enlisting Central Asia countries for help in stabilizing Afghanistan and not as much on trying to pivot from Afghanistan to develop Central Asia. And in that sense, especially governments like Uzbekistan could be as much of a harm as they are a help in terms of how the Karimov regime has actively contributed to the rise of the IMU and in a lot of ways ensures that they're a problem in Afghanistan by keeping them out of his own country and by not kind of engaging with them on a certain level. You see similar things happening in Tajikistan, like all the violence in the east in Gorno-Badakhshan this summer. It's the same idea. It's these unstable systems intimately tied to the drug smuggling networks out of Afghanistan that have ripple effects further north. I mean, there's a role for them to play in trying to stem that, but I mean, that's that's up in the air, I think, as far as people talk about it. Like, do you guys have any thoughts on that, or is it kind of out of left field for you? Anyone else? I think I saw a hand shoot up somewhere.
I have something that's unrelated, though.
Yeah, please.
Mike Child, I'm an Army officer, recently returned from Kandahar province. The issue I wanted to bring up, I tend to agree with Nick, your kind of pessimistic issue, or excuse me, mindset about the situation. But Matt, going back to what you were saying about local governance and how that has to be kind of the solution, one of the major issues that we ran into is the convoluted structure of the Constitution and the decentralized government, and how basically the district governor and all of his associate ministers at the district and provincial level don't really have any power, and they have to go back to the central government to get anything approved. So with a local governance, that it can be an alternative to the immediate responsiveness of the Taliban. Do you think that restructuring the Constitution is the way forward, or do you think that the Afghan government would be receptive to that, or do you have any ideas as to a solution for local government?
Constitution's a big question. I mean, I think you know, when we're talking about, you're talking about going back to Kabul, you're talking about use of resources, largely. The sort of governance that I think we're talking about, if we're talking primarily about security, it's about use of violence, use of force. There are very, very little resources that Afghanistan's going to have, really, to decide. You know, it's not going to be building hospitals, you know, in the coming 10 years in the country on a grand scale. So it's going to have to, there will be needs to be some changes in the Constitution in order to make sure that those local power brokers can decide how to use their militia and their forces to stabilize their own areas. Yeah.
Personally, I would like to. I think that having tried the Constitution for 9 or so years, we realize that there's a lot of flaws in it, and the subnational governance is one of the crucial ones. I mean, the roles of district and provincial governors is just not really prescribed in the Constitution at all. District councils are mentioned, I think, solely in their capacity to select a third of the upper house, and in the fact that they don't exist means that power rests now with the president. I think it would be a great idea, and clearly constitutions can go through different forms. Not my period, but the current American Constitution is not the first attempt at it. I think, isn't that correct? There was iterations before that. But the trouble with Afghanistan is I don't think the Afghan elites would be particularly interested in changing it, and I don't think at this late stage in the game it's worth the international community trying to... Well, I don't think they've got the will to try and fix that now, but yeah, it would be a good thing to do.
I was just going to jump in and suggest that one of the challenges we have in a way is that there is essentially a hollow state. You have a government that kind of has the semblance or the appearance of having institutions, when none of the institutions really work, and the only one that's received, I think, really serious mentorship and money and attention and time has been the armed forces. And in a way, you're making almost a Praetorian state. It's a military without a government to work for.
What could possibly go wrong?
Like, you know, but also, what could possibly go right from the other side of it? I mean, there are examples of military states becoming civilian states over time. It's not an easy process or a quick process. It does happen. It's not automatically destined for failure. But there are substantial barriers to actually getting a successful result of that. Usually they tend to result in collapse, and I think that's what we're talking about, either trying to stave off or in some way manage when it eventually happens. But you know, I'm still stuck on this. Like, is there a way to actually prevent that collapse? I mean, apart from just wishing for a new constitutional order within kind of the realistic bounds that we have with our current problem set, is there a way that we can either help there be a soft landing, or in a way avoid that kind of a landing at all? I mean, I'm actually surprised at the amount of pessimism in this room. Usually there's at least someone who has an idea for how to make this happen. I mean, I'm putting this out to everyone here again. Like, do you guys have any thoughts about kind of softening the blow?
Mark Kushama, Marine, recently back from Afghanistan, spent a year in Marja working with the district governor, actually, and the district community council as well. We had a lot of progress over a year. The problem is, I think you hit it on the head, it's sustainability. We pumped a lot of resources. We have multiple battalions of Marines in there. Can we keep that up? No. Is there some semblance of local governance occurring? Yes. The problem is if the distribution of resources, and that's the number one problem I saw, is they can't get anything out of provincial level. It took us through coalition people harassing provincial level officials through the PRT up there or up in the embassy in Kabul to get resources down to the district level. We're not going to be there the whole time. And there just doesn't seem to be a buy-in from the government, the central government, to let go of those resources. And if it is, it's usually some type of patronage kind of method. So to me, there is a chance at the local level, but you do have to change the constitution. You do have to do something different. Because we did see a lot of progress, and there was a lot of good politics. And the one thing we learned is when Afghans want to do something, it will happen. If it's just us or Battalion Commander X's bright idea, it rarely happens the way we want it. And like counter-narcotics, as you know.
So I'm laughing that counter-narcotics elicits bitter laughter from everyone who's been to Helmand Province.
I mean, that's big grill in the room in Helmand.
I'm Dan Roper. I'm an adjunct professor at the Near East South Asia Center. Last couple of weeks, we ran a course for 2 weeks with 26 different Afghan junior minister level from across 13 different ministries. And I just want to share with you some of the things that they would say. Again, no one's got the silver bullet to it. They're concerned with the issue of Pakistan, and again, not Pakistan as an adversary, but just the overall dynamic of what's occurring on both sides of the border. And getting to the point of the controlling of resources was almost unanimous, and they weren't programmed. I mean, they were all kind of in a free-thinking mode, talking about corruption, that both constitutionally it's set up so there are some challenges and the distribution of resources, that it's almost built in where there has to be corruption because the resources aren't getting to the right place, and therefore you get this self-defeating spiral as opposed to something you can build on. The more you put into it, the more you contaminate the situation. So I just want to share that. The other thing I would say, the one point of optimism I took from spending a couple weeks with them is they're realizing they own the problem. Okay, it's no longer all this stuff is going to be there. So you got to look, there's a good side and a bad side to us going down. And there's a realization that they're picking it up. It's going to be theirs. Their challenge, and they're afraid they're going to go off the end of the cliff in 2014. But they did realize they now have a strategic communication challenge to demonstrate that we're getting something for the investment. So again, it's kind of a random shot. If they were sitting here, I think they'd share some of those thoughts with you.
The corruption issue, I think, is really interesting. It's obviously something which greatly exercises us, and rightly so, in the disbursement of our own scarce taxpayers' dollars. I pay taxes in the United States, I can say, now and then. But where I think it's really interesting, though, is if you're sort of, and I'm not trying to justify it, but I'm trying to be empathetic, is why some of the corruption happens. And I think, and there's a really interesting thing going on, and when you announce a withdrawal, and the role model for this, or a data point for this, can be the British and French colonial withdrawals post-war. Because, you know, once you've reached the point where there's no domestic interest and there's no national strategic interest and it's just too painful and too expensive and you won out, quite rightly say, we're going. And in between the time you say you're going and the time at which you say at which you will be gone, you have a massive upsurge in violence. I mean, it happened almost every single one, about the halfway point between the two. And that happens, understandably, because people fight for the future cake. Suddenly, it's the struggle about what happens next. Now, in Afghanistan, there's not, it's not quite the same. There is now a government, you know, and but where I think, but it becomes crucial in people's thinking, because increasingly people want money, and they don't necessarily want money they don't want money so that they can spend it on flash wristwatches, you know, nice cars. They want it so that they can protect themselves and their constituents, their client group, whoever that might be. So if I'm a deputy minister of the interior and I'm a Tajik from Takar, I want the money so that my guys can be armed and able to defend themselves in any very uncertain future scenario. And I think this drives a lot of people's accumulation of money, and it goes down the trade, down the line. If I'm a junior public official, I want the money so I can get out. I want the money so I can get my family and myself out of Afghanistan. You know, certainly to Pakistan, or ideally to Germany or United States. I'm going to live in Virginia, yeah? Because that's what happened last time. Is that the wealthy, when the Civil War started, and the communists, the wealthy get out first. People want to go, and I would want to protect my family. And the Afghan farmers, increasingly, I reckon will have a spike in opium cultivation, because people will want the cash in their back pocket, because it's fungible. They want to be able to have an asset which they can take with them. So the tedious thing, I think, about this, the problem, is increasingly as 2014 comes along, these kind of the increasingly people will try and rent more, take more rents from the system where they can.
Right, so on that really happy note, I have to say that we're out of time for today. But I do want to thank you guys for showing up. I mean, this is unusually substantive for an Afghanistan event, so I thank you very much for your participation here. Have a great day.